crisis points in the Middle East and the South China Sea are coming at a very inconvenient time for the United States Navy. It is experiencing a carrier gap. Vice Admiral Peter Daley, U.S. Navy retired, is Chief Executive Officer of the U.S. Naval Institute, former Deputy Commander and Chief of Staff of U.S. Fleet Forces Command, and former Commander of the Nimitz Strike Group, here to explain what the carrier gap is, why it's a problem, and what the Navy and Congress can do to close it. Admiral, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Can you define the concept of a carrier gap and tell us briefly how we got here? Thanks for your time this morning, Admiral.
Well, pleasure to join you, Francis. The Navy does heel-to-toe deployments and has been doing so for well over 40 years. And the thing that underpins those is having ready ships that are available, very tightly wound maintenance plans that support it. And when you get to a point that we've been in after 10 years of surging the force, maintenance piles up. It'd be like if you had a car and you said, hey, I'm going to give you more money for gas, but you're going to use that car, you're going to hit bigger maintenance checks faster that are more expensive, more complex, and that has added up on the Navy.
And you pointed out at an event that I read about over the summer that with these deployments going longer, that starts really, you called it a vicious cycle, and it strikes me that unfortunately it's circling the drain. I mean, when the ships are in the water longer, they're in the dock shorter, and that means that they have less time to prepare for the next deployment, which means, I guess, that they're less prepared. Is that a fair derivation on my part?
Yes, it is. It's a cumulative effect. And, we saw large expense for the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And some people liken that to a defense buildup like the Reagan defense buildup. For the Navy, though, those extra dollars spent supporting the wars were spent to operate. There was no buildup. This was consumption.
Is there a connection from your position as a former commander between the budget situation that we're in, where budgets are shrinking, and the consumption piece that you just talked about, or are they essentially the same thing, or maybe two separate items but combined at the same time?
I think it's the latter. In a world that is much more volatile, we have appropriated less for defense in the last 4 years and have done so in a disruptive manner with continuing resolutions and fiscal cliffs and shutdowns. And this has eroded the fleet's ability to respond. So we're behind on critical maintenance and modernization for our Navy.
So this is not just a case of more money being necessary when you use the term disruptive manner, which I think is very appropriate to describe the way in which money's been directed to the Defense Department the last several years.
No, that's exactly right, because every time there's a slowdown, I mentioned earlier this was very tightly wound, the whole cycle of deployment and providing that eye-watering, critical forward presence depends on being able to turn these ships in their maintenance cycles. And if you get off track, which the Navy has now got a backlog, you pay a price for that.
Your colleague at the Naval Institute, Scott Christensen, pointed me to a column by George Will in the Washington Post a week or so ago. My friend at the Center for New American Security, Captain Jerry Hendricks, points out that the newest carrier that the Navy will commission next year, the USS Gerald R. Ford, is carrying almost a $13 billion price tag. And Jerry points out China could build more than 1,200 of its premier anti-ship missiles for the cost of one Ford carrier, and it's conceivable that just one of those 1,200 could knock that carrier out of the fight for several months, damage it badly enough that it needed to come back to port. Does that mean that we're thinking about the structure of the carrier-class ship incorrectly, the number of them that we need, or does it mean we're thinking about the way that we defend against attacks like those potential missiles the wrong way, or maybe neither of the above?
Well, first I'd mention that for any taxpayer, that's a huge amount of money that was mentioned for the cost of the Ford-class carrier. I would point out that the Navy has not redesigned and done the R&D and all the modernization for the basic carrier design since the late 60s, early 70s, when it designed and brought us the Nimitz-class, which is the carrier that's out there now. So this is a lot of money at the beginning with a lot of new technologies, some of which will make the carrier more survivable, some of which will modernize it to defend against future threats. So I think it's disingenuous to cite the cost, but also cite the potential vulnerabilities. For instance, it would be like, Francis, somebody saying somebody created a new high-powered rifle, so police are obsolete. It's kind of absurd. And when you look at the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan, $1.6 trillion, believe it or not, the carrier is still the best solution.
The carrier issue, it plays into a broader discussion in the Navy as well. As to how many ships in the Navy fleet is the appropriate number. And that's also a discussion that I wonder if it's the appropriate discussion right now, whether we're thinking about it strategically or thinking about it from an inventory perspective. What's your take on that, Admiral Daley?
Well, I think that over the years, throughout history, statesmen and strategists have coveted options rather than all or none course of actions. And we spent all that money on Iraq and Afghanistan, and we don't have a lot to show. I would offer that carriers do not depend on an expensive footprint ashore, and they create options. And the fact that we can generate the sorties from the deck of the carrier without permission generates other advantages as well. Long-range missiles and ICBMs are not credible options in most scenarios. So we do need these very important pieces of hardware, and we need them in sufficient numbers, to your other point.
I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation the ongoing situation in the South China Sea. China's building up islands out of essentially nothing, you know, rocks in the middle of the ocean. And the Obama administration is considering sending ships in that direction. They won't be carriers, most likely. But what's the carrier role in ensuring access in a part of the world like the South China Sea, Admiral?
Well, those operations that the administration is contemplating are freedom of navigation exercises. We don't want a country to go out and create an island, call it sovereign territory, and start restricting the flow of traffic. So the Navy, throughout the world, every year, makes it a point to establish our rights to use the international waters that are out there. And in this particular case, these manufactured items, which the PACOM commander, Admiral Harry Harris, calls the Great Wall of Sand, is a particular foul because they're making land that wasn't there before.
Are you struck by the fact that very little of the world community has followed Admiral Harris in talking about how these islands are kind of made out of nothing? It strikes me that historically, if the United States would have said something along that line, somebody would have come along behind us and said, yeah, that makes sense to me. It makes sense to us as a nation and kind of stood beside us. And I'm not seeing much of that in this particular case.
Well, I think that there is a high level of concern about the Chinese behavior, and you could see it where it really shows up the most, Francis, is in the allies. You really can see that the upshot of what China's been doing has been to force South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and other nations in the Western Pacific closer to us. So that concern, I think, gets a lot greater as you get closer to the situation. It's real and it's there.
Admiral, I want to go back to the carrier gap issue and paint maybe a rosier scenario than is reasonable at this point. But let's say that a budget deal comes out of Congress in the next several months that does wind up appropriating more money for the Defense Department overall. It would be reasonable to assume that some slice of that would wind up with the Navy to help address the carrier gap. And let's assume that we get out of, in the next year or so, this rhythm of disruptive appropriations patterns that you talked about earlier. What are the next steps for the Navy and for Congress to be able to address this gap and revitalize the health of the carrier fleet?
Well, I think focusing on your very last part there, I think we have to all acknowledge that after years of operating the fleet at a high level of surge, there's an accumulation of maintenance that has to be addressed. And so you have to, for lack of a better analogy, just slow the race down a little bit. So I think we're stuck with a few less options in the near term, but we have to pay on the essential maintenance to make sure that we can build our way back out of this. Right now, the Navy has taken steps to slow down, and you start to see that with this gap and other manifestations. But what they're really doing is trying to catch up on the future, and we have to let them do that with enough money and without disruption.
Can they do that even if world events dictate the need for those carriers to be more active than they are today and or have been in the last several years?
Well, you can make exceptions any time, but if you make exceptions every time, it catches up with you, and that's kind of what got us here.
Excellent insight, Admiral. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you, sir.